Thank you very much indeed for your warm welcome. Please would you turn to page 900 of the Church Bibles and to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel 7, 1-14 on page 900. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. Daniel declared, "I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, and four great beasts came up out of the sea, different from one another. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. Then as I looked, its wings were plucked off, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. And the mind of a man was given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, like a bear. It was raised up on one side. It had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And it was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.' After this, I looked, and behold, another, like a leopard, with 4 wings of a bird on its back. And the beast had 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another horn, a little one, before which 3 of the 1st horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. And as I looked, the beast was killed, and its body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed." This is the word of the Lord.
Well, Simon, thank you very much for reading, and it is very good news to have you with us. Please take our greetings back to the many friends of ours in Cape Town and to your family as well. And may I welcome you very warmly to St. Helens this afternoon for the last in this series. Yesterday evening we were hearing from a Christian aid worker from a country in South Asia here at St. Helens, and recently that country, you will have read about it in the papers, had seen a man sentenced to death. His crime: converting to Christianity. after much pressure from the international community, the sentence was withdrawn and he was given asylum. But this aid worker said that several of the employees were discussing the matter in the office and they were agreed. Conversion should result in death. Another worker from the same agency, also Christian and national from that nation, by chance had recently overheard his own brothers and sisters discussing the removal of his children from his family. The crime? He is a Christian. Now, over the last 6 weeks, we've been looking at what it means for God's people to live for God in a hostile culture. We've called it Daniel for Grown-Ups. And we've seen Daniel and his friends facing opposition, very hostile opposition. And we've noted that here in England, for the last century at least, we have been living in extraordinary times. We have not faced significant hostility from the state or from the religious establishment. And yet the Bible tells us that that is the norm for Christians. And as we look across the world, we see that to be the norm. My personal view is that things are bound to grow more difficult for Christians as our culture moves further and further away from its Christian heritage. You don't need to be a great observer to notice that. We've already seen it here in the city, and we've joked about the Sun headline. Do you remember at Christmas time, "Is this the most dangerous man in Britain?" with a picture of Jesus in the manger. We laugh at the intolerance of the politically correct fundamentalists, but it's there, isn't it? The wonderful thing about Daniel, though, is that Daniel doesn't just give us a description of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego as they stand up to in the face of hostility. If we just had the description, I fear that we would be saying, well, look, that's Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They're mighty ones, and little old me, you know, that's not my kind of ball game. But Daniel doesn't give us that. Instead, in this first major section of Daniel, we've noted that it operates like a kind of giant sandwich, and chapter 2 and chapter 7 on the outside give us the engine room, if you like, the enabling vision that make it possible for any man or woman of God to stand for God in a hostile environment. How is it that God's people, how is it that any Christian can stand firm when the state or the religious establishment of the nation is deeply opposed? And there are three things in this chapter 7 that are identified for us. First, there will be centuries of hostile aggression. Now, before we get into chapter 7, we just need to note that it is a new form of literature. It's called apocalyptic. It's still part of the main section, chapter 2 through to chapter 7. It's in the same language, Aramaic, but this is a new style of writing. We find it elsewhere in the Bible, in the book of Revelation, in Ezekiel, in parts of the Gospels. And apocalyptic is like a kind of, if you're familiar, an impressionist painting. We're not meant to get immersed in the details. If you get too tightly close to the details, you lose the big picture. Just like if you get too close up to an impressionist painting with your magnifying glass and look at just one corner, you say, well, what on earth is that all about? No, the point of impressionist painting is you stand back, and as you stand back, you get the big picture. And that is the idea with apocalyptic literature. Sometimes you find people approaching the book of Revelation and these chapters of Daniel with the kind of magnifying glass in one hand and a calendar in the other, trying to plot specific details and match up specific ideas with specific people. That's not the point of apocalyptic literature. It's designed rather to tell us what the world will look like, the main features that we will find on the world stage as history unravels. So you will have noticed, as we read verse 2 to 8 of chapter 7, that four beasts are introduced. And verse 17, over the page there, we are told that these four great beasts are four kings who shall arise out of the earth. And the point is that there will be this period on the stage of human history of hostile aggression, of opposition. The four kings do actually correspond to various empires, Babylonian, Persian, Greek, Roman. But that's not the point of the apocalyptic literature. The point is to tell us that there will be kings like the bear of verse 5. You can see him there, violent, militaristic. Another beast, a second one, like a bear, was raised up on one side with three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. It was told, arise, devour much flesh. Here is this bear raising his head from his bloody meal with three ribs sticking out from between his teeth as he then is told to go further and gorge himself. There will be kings like that. There will be kings like the lion who is raised up to be like a man, powerful, royal, swift, mighty, but eventually benign and rational like Nebuchadnezzar. There will be kings like the leopard of verse 6, with four wings of a bird and four heads and dominion given to it right the way across to the four corners of the earth. And we've all seen empires like that. Again, Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon, Greece in the 3rd century BC, Britain in the 19th century. And there will be, once in a while, rulers whose indescribable wickedness is directed specifically against God and his people. Verse 7. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong. It had great iron teeth. It devoured and broke in pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it and had 10 horns. And then in verse 21, we're told that the aggression of this violent beast was directed against God's people, the saints, and that this violent beast prevailed over the saints until the Ancient of Days came in judgment. And then in verse 25, we see that he speaks words against the Most High and wears out the saints, looking to change the law and the time. So, blasphemous, persecuting God's people, and supremely arrogant, looking to change and rearrange the God-given order of things, dates and times, and to stamp out any recognition of God in a culture. There will be beasts like that. A Domitian in Roman times, a Nero, a Queen Mary, a Stalin, a Muslim government that is determined to eradicate Christians. Now, this seems to me extraordinarily helpful to us Christians as we think about living for God, because it means that, unlike the political and social commentators we so often hear from, the Christian man or woman is not a kind of sentimental, wishful thinker. So much of our contemporary social, political thinking has brought into the belief that there is a kind of inevitable evolutionary progress of humanity that will go on getting better and better and better and better. So that, like Neville Chamberlain, we find it almost impossible to come to terms with the reality of fallen human nature when we see it writ large in a Kosovo or a Chechnya or a Baghdad. God's word makes sense of our world. Jesus says you will hear wars and rumours of wars. Nation will rise against nation. There will be centuries of violent oppression. There will be dictators. There will be wickedness because of the nature of humanity. And therefore the Christian lives in the world as a realist, with their eyes open, not their head in the sand, aware that our world will have wicked rulers strutting on the stage of human history. And it won't surprise us when we find ourselves facing opposition. The striking thing, though, is, as we look at these early verses, is who is in charge. Let me read the verses to you, and you'll see that there's very definitely somebody in charge of all that's going on. So, verse 4, "Then, as I looked, its wings were plucked off. It was lifted up from the ground and made to stand." And verse 5, "Another beast, a second one, like a bear, was raised up. It was told, 'Arise, devour much flesh.'" And verse 6, "Another, like a leopard with four wings on its back, was given dominion." In other words, this is not out of control. All of these world rulers are actually being given power. There is a supreme sovereign Lord ruling over all the nations of history. And you find exactly the same thing in the book of Revelation, interestingly, when you come to the four horsemen of the apocalypse: death, famine, military conquest, and disease. They are sent out by the supreme sovereign Lord of history. So that there will be, yes, centuries of hostile aggression. God will raise up rulers to bring judgment on nations and to extend his grace to other nations as he sees fit. And the Christian man or woman like Daniel will know that nothing is out of control. This is precisely as God told us it would be. There will be rulers and powers and violence and nations all under the sovereign rule of the Lord, who raised up and put in place Nebuchadnezzar. God did. We saw that. Who brought down Belshazzar? God did. Who raised up Pilate? God did. Christians then don't need to walk around with their head in the sand. There will be centuries of hostile aggression. Now, on its own, I don't think that's an enormous amount of comfort, is it? I mean, it's nice to know what's going on the world stage, but I guess on its own, that doesn't give us a huge amount of comfort. It just makes us realists. But verses 9 to 12, we are now taken into the divine courtroom at the end of time and shown that there will be a day of final decision. And after the tumult and wickedness and apparent unaccountability of verses 1 to 8, verses 9 to 12 is a picture of ordered calm and settled dignity. Notice the purity of the judge. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. Notice the consuming holiness of his character. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire, and a stream of fire issued and came out from before him, from this white-hot furnace of divine holiness. Notice the universality of his judgment. Thousands, 1,000,000 served him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. And notice the all-seeing rightness of his judgment. The books were opened. Every thought, every word, every deed. No motive unknown, no inclination unexamined. Nothing overlooked. So alongside the centuries of hostile aggression, we have this day of final decision, which shouldn't surprise us. All of us long for some sort of final reckoning. There's a dim awareness, isn't there? You find it in the tabloids, as the tabloids demand justice. We don't need to argue for it. We see the demand for justice every evening on our television screens at the moment. Portugal playing Holland, you cried out all the way through. There has to be someone to whom these people are ultimately accountable. And the glorious thing about this judgment is that it will be the pure judge who is utterly holy, unavoidable, and fair. So the language of apocalyptic literature is not linear, but history is linear. And in verses 9 to 12, we're being shown that we are going somewhere, that we are not like David Bowie's Major Tom, you know, floating in that tin can, coming from nowhere and going to nowhere. No, there is a final day of decision. But it's more specific than that, isn't it, in verse 11 and 12. The horn that had spoken blasphemous words and deliberately persecuted God's people and puffed himself up, this horn is now brought specifically to judgment. And it is surely this vision that sustained Daniel. I looked then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking. As I looked, the beast was killed and its body destroyed and given over to be burned with fire. Now I thought to myself, where is it that Daniel got the courage to say to Nebuchadnezzar back in chapter 2, as he announced to him, no wise men, enchanters, magicians or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked? Where did Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego get the courage and the ability to say to King Nebuchadnezzar, as they did in chapter 3 and verse 16, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you that we will not serve your gods. Where is it that Daniel had found the courage to say to King Belshazzar, just a few years after this vision, as he did in chapter 5, that Belshazzar had not humbled his heart, though he knew all this, but had lifted himself up against the Lord of heaven. Where did these guys find the courage? Well, they found the courage because they knew that there was the ultimate day of reckoning, and the men that they spoke to would face the living God. We see it in Jesus, don't we? As Pilate says to him, do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? And Jesus replies, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. So here is the second aspect of this vision which gives Daniel and his friends courage to stand for God, the knowledge that there is a day of final decision, that all of us will face God, the Ancient of Days, and that the ones who persecute you themselves will find themselves under judgment on the last day. It's Jesus in Matthew chapter 10 who said to his disciples, as we just turn to it on page 983, have no fear of them. For nothing is covered that will not be revealed, or hidden that will not be known. What I tell you in the dark, say in the light, and what you hear whispered, proclaim on the housetops, and do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather, fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Well, that then leaves us asking, if the centuries of hostile aggression will be brought to a close by a day of final decision, what is it that will replace the rule of fallen man in God's new creation? And the answer is here in verses 13 and 14, which I want us to look at closely in the last two or three minutes. These are some of the most famous verses in the Bible. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient Days and was presented before him. The images of a human. The language used is the language used of humanity in general in the Bible. So in Psalm 8, God speaks of the Son of Man, referring to human beings in all our brilliant splendor as God made us before the fall. What is man that you are mindful of him? The Son of Man that you care for him. But the language, the Son of Man, one like a Son of Man, is also used in the Bible to speak of God's King, the King of Israel. So Psalm 80 speaks of God's special King over his people as the man of your right hand, the Son of Man, whom you have made strong for yourself. And therefore, when we are given the language of one like a Son of Man, we have here the language of perfect royal humanity. But we can't stop there, because the Son of Man is not only human in this picture, he is also heavenly. He comes on the clouds of the heavens. He is able to approach the Ancient of Days. No mere human can do that. He is led into God's presence. He's given all authority and all glory and all sovereign power. And all peoples, nations and languages worship him. So that this is no mere human. He is human, but he is also heavenly. He is divine, but he is also human. And this last part of the vision points then to one man with universal dominion. Centuries of hostile aggression, a day of final decision, but one man with universal dominion, to whom is given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations and languages should serve him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. I want us to look one last time at these verses, and I want us to look at verse 13 closely, and I want to ask the question, which direction is this Son of Man going in? I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days. Now, which direction is he going in? Why, he's going up from the earth to the Ancient of Days on the clouds of heaven. This Son of Man, this heavenly, divine human, is being raised up from the earth to the place of all rule and power at the right hand of God on high. Now, I'm sure you know this, that when Jesus walked the earth, he used the title of himself, the Son of Man. That's what he called himself. And in Matthew's Gospel, as he faced his trial, he said to the high priest, I've jotted down on the sheet there for you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. So that when the disciples witnessed Jesus departing the earth, they saw him leave in the clouds. Here is the Son of Man, Jesus, who claimed the title for himself, who died and rose again, now ascending to the Father in heaven on the clouds as the enthroned Son of Man. So that when Stephen in Acts is persecuted and is about to be stoned, he sees heaven opened and he sees the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God, for which he is then stoned because of the blasphemy. What is it then that keeps the Christian standing in the face of persecution? Well, we are told there will be centuries of hostile aggression. We are realists, not sentimentalists like so much of our culture. There will be a day of final decision. Yes, every man, woman, and child will one day stand before the living God. But there is one man who has been given universal dominion, the Son of Man, who now sits at the right hand of God on high, and who will come again on the clouds in final judgment. Let's pray together. Jesus said, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations. We thank you, our Father, for this vision of what has become reality, the rule of Jesus Christ. We thank you for him, his perfect humanity, his heavenly glory. We thank you that we saw he is heavenly as he walked the earth, your divine Son, and yet fully and perfectly human. We thank you that he now sits at your right hand and reigns on high and will one day return to rule for eternity. We ask our Father, therefore, that you would help us to stand wherever you have placed us, to be courageous and to make disciples of all nations for your name's sake. Amen.